Hello and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Jeff Grubb. Welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's awesome to get this chance to talk with you. I actually met you about 15 years ago, and you probably don't remember this at all because I'm sure you met lots and lots of people.
Oh, goodness, but, where?
Well, it was at ArenaNet, and they were having, as far as I know, the only community day where they brought in people from the various fan sites across the world.
Yes.
And so I was the representative from Guild Wars Guru.
Okay. And, I love Guild Wars Guru. It was a very nice site.
Oh, I liked it a lot. I was sad when it went away. Mm-hmm. I actually enjoyed Guild Wars a lot. I mm-hmm. played probably too much. I especially liked Nightfall. So that was really nice. Mm-hmm. And when it went over to Guild Wars 2, it just didn't do it for me. So unfortunately. So it's my daughter still plays Guild Wars 2 though.
Oh yeah. My wife is a big fan of Guild Wars 2. She kidnapped my account. And I taught her to play once over Christmas break, and then I had to go get my own account because she sort of just took it over.
There you go.
And now she's getting her Skyscale, which is a rideable dragon and has an incredibly long process of you have to get all the components for the saddle. Then you have to basically go everywhere and basically get the readings so you can train the dragon. Then you've got to train the dragon for things. It's a long process. So that's what she's been doing in her copious spare time in the evenings. Nice. She's a tax preparer by profession, an enrolled agent, which is sort of a super tax preparer. And so this time of year, she has been very, very busy.
Well, at least, unfortunately, because of the pandemic, I guess, we have a little bit more time for that.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people have been playing games, so which is a good thing. Yep.
So Jeff is the author of numerous novels, short stories, and comics, as well as a computer and role-playing game writer and designer. He was part of TSR throughout the 80s, and his list of credits includes author of Marvel Superheroes RPG, Spelljammer, the AD&D Manual of the Planes, as well as having a hand in Unearthed Arcana, Dragonlance, Forgotten Realms, D20 Star Wars, and D20 Modern. After leaving Wizards of the Coast, Jeff went on to become a writer and designer for the Guild Wars MMO RPG. His current position is as senior narrative designer for Amazon Game Studios. So, Jeff, you've had a very long and storied career working on numerous seminal RPG properties, as well as crafting over a dozen novels in many of these same settings. Can you talk about your path to becoming this huge writer and game designer? How'd you do that?
I have secret origin time. Actually, I am, by training, a civil engineer. Purdue
Did
University.
Wow.
So I basically, I started building, air pollution equipment, and I end up building worlds is sort of I'm a guy who's been swallowed by his hobbies. when I was in junior high school, started playing like war games, SPI, Avalon mm-hmm. Hill, Diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And when I got to Purdue, attended the Purdue War Gamer Club, which was like Friday nights. And I got there got in there, and there were some people with, carpet that you'd laid down and doing tank battles, and a couple mm-hmm. people with board games. And there was a group in the corner who were rolling dice. They didn't have a board. They didn't have anything set up, and they were just yelling at each other. I wandered over and I asked, what's going on? They handed me 3 6-sided dice and said, here, we need a cleric. And after that, it was all downhill. This was about 75. So it was early in, this is when we had the 3 small booklets mm-hmm. in the wood grain box. We didn't even have the white box out yet. Mm-hmm. And Greyhawk supplement. That was sort of mm-hmm. our core right then. And I started my own campaign by the end of the year, brought it back to Pittsburgh, taught friends how to play. And because I was at Purdue University, We got involved with Gen Con, which was up in Kenosha. My first Gen Con was the first year at Kenosha. And we would go up to Kenosha. We had a friend who had a, whose parents had a house on Lake Geneva. And so we'd play games there. Then we go to Gen Con. Then we go to college. So it was a nice, you know, like last fling before going to school. And because of going to Gen Con, got involved with the D&D Open run by Bob Blake at the time. And at one point, my after finishing running, one of my friends was unimpressed with the offering and said in a loud voice, you know, we could do a better job than that. And he said it within Bob's hearing. And Bob spun on his heel and said, congratulations, you just volunteered to write next year's D&D Open.
Very nice.
And I ended up heading up the project in part because during this time I had graduated. I was working as an engineer building air pollution control equipment, which are sort of glorified vacuum cleaners on stilts. And our company took a hit because they weren't enforcing environmental laws in the early 80s. And so they laid off the company. So I had time on my hands. And from that, I basically corralled and organized the D&D Open for that year. And it was myself, two of my friends, and Len Lukofka, who was the big name writer, who had, you know, he'd published stuff. We have seen his articles in, you know, Dragon Magazine. And on the basis of that, we delivered it in like February for an August convention. Wow. And on the strength of that, I was hired as a full-time game designer for TSR. Now, I had written in college. I had won some writing awards. I had worked on the local radio station. We were the we had a humor show on Saturday nights, the Pegasus Engineering Company. And that was our, you know, big claim to fame. But really getting into writing as a profession was my experience at TSR. And we did all sorts of things. We were doing, you know, doing modules. We were learning how to do new games. We were, you know, playtesting all sorts of things. And from TSR, that's the where we started with, you know, Marvel Superheroes, Dragonlance, Forgotten Realms. And over the course of the 80s, that's how I started writing novels, how I started writing comic books, provided other opportunities. And I've, you know, eventually I left TSR. This was before they were bought by WotC, Wizards of the Coast. And then after a couple of years, came to work for Wizards of the Coast and moved out here to Seattle, stayed with them for three or four years until, you know, we had again layoffs. And at that point I made the jump over to computer games. You mentioned Guild Wars. I've worked on, I'm working on stuff for Amazon Games, which I of which I cannot speak. my first game of that period was The Settlers, which was for Ubisoft in Germany. And, you know, it was the experience of working in a long, very long distance with the company in Dusseldorf. And it was, you know, a real, real lot of fun, and I really enjoyed it. Basically, but it was not, that was not the first computer game I worked on. I also, we also did the story for the ancient gold box game from SSI, Curse of the Azure Bonds,
which
was based on the novel that my wife and I wrote. So it was kind of a semi sequel to the novel that the two of us wrote.
Wow, and so. Were you doing novels concurrently as you were working at TSR and WotC, or?
Yes, I was. And, you know, it often was a case because I knew where the bodies were buried, having, you know, helped create these worlds, that I had a strong knowledge base. I had a strong narrative sense. And also, to tell you the truth, they didn't give advances to the employees who were writing novels. So in my spare time, I would write the novels. This was Manual of the Planes as well. And then during my day job, I'd be designing stuff.
So typical like freelance work, but for whole novels for the company though.
Whole novels, and on the assumption that it was going to be published, which was, you know, always a risk when you were dealing with that.
Well, you kind of had a built-in audience and probably a lot of demand for these, so it seems like that was a fair bet, I would imagine.
It was a fair bet, and we were expanding out at the time. We were basically, Marvel Superheroes got us into the direct sale comic book shops, which were a new thing, and were coming of age, and, they were looking for other things to carry besides just comics, and with this accessible superhero game branded by Marvel, we got into a new market. Our novels, we expanded out into the bookstores, bookstores with sort of, we always talk about the shared world ghetto at the end of all the science fiction novels that are all alphabetical. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the Star Trek novels, the Star Wars novels, the Forgotten Realms novels. Mm-hmm. And working in shared worlds, because for many years I was the traffic cop of the realms. In other words, I was the one who said, yeah, if you're going to Moonshays, you should talk to Doug. If you're dealing with Drow, you should talk to Bob Salvatore. Basically coordinating between everybody who's all running around, all doing wonderful stuff at once within the world. So it was very enjoyable. So it basically gave me an opportunity to, and it wasn't like, hi, I work in the world. We had to jump through hoops. We had to, basically establish ourselves. We had to present material and say, yes, we've got the ability to do this. And, and working with the book department was fantastic.
So when you're crafting these novels, to what extent are you having to stay rigid to the existing lore? And to what extent are you allowed to create new lore, related to the game in the setting?
It varies. It's often the creation of new lore revolves around things that haven't been talked about yet. Mm-hmm. Again, since I worked on creating a lot of the worlds, I had an ability to make something happen within the game setting and then support it with the novels I've been writing. So it's very interesting. We kept when I was first working on the realms, Ed Greenwood would send me all of his material and it would arrive and it was wrapped in this heavy Canadian cellophane with multiple layers. It would take like 15 minutes for me to unwrap it. And basically that became our Bible. And basically based on what people were doing, we would check against the Bible, see what we've said in the original material and then what we have written since, and then provide that information to the writers to be able to give them the basis they need to work on it.
And most of this you were tracking like manually, or did you actually have like a project management system to track? Here's what's going on in here, so make sure you don't go in this direction when you do this.
Actually, it was pretty much ad hoc. We were putting it together, and we would have our stumbles occasionally. At one point, Bob went to Baldur's Gate, and we didn't know about that until it was later in the process. And then we said, okay, what did he say? How does it fit in with what we've done? How do we make it work? Unreliable narrators are your best friend. if they're saying that, this doesn't quite light up. Well, you're listening to Volo there. Mm-hmm. And Volo tends to make stuff up. So, the unreliable narrator is our friend. Volo, by the way, got his name from a town in Northern Illinois, right on the border with Wisconsin. And we would drive through it on the way. It was Volo. It was at Volo Bog. The Volo Auto Museum was there. Everything was named Volo. Mm-hmm. And so when we created this boisterous, unreliable, musician, historian, Volo was a perfect name because he was the guy who was basically pulling all the information together. Mm-hmm. And it was Ed who named him Volothomp Geldarm because that's a very Ed name that sounds
a
dictionary fell down a set of stairs. So,
working on these novels and these RPGs and then transitioning to doing narratives for video games, I'm presuming, how does that process compare? How different is it? How similar is it?
From a storytelling aspect, it's similar. Computer games have a lot of limitations operating on them, like animation, like, you know, frame rate. Working in Guild Wars, in Guild Wars 2, a designer would come and say, here's the adventure I want to write. This is the event, and we're going to go out, and you're going to pick up a bunny, and you're going to carry it across the field. And I said, okay, do you have an animation for picking up the bunny? Mm-hmm. Well, no. Do you have how are you going to hold the bunny? You know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's a very pragmatic sort of look. And basically that affects how the stories are written with what we can do with the game itself. And we can, you know, commission a new animation if we so choose. But basically that's going to be something that's, you know, a cost that they're going to have to look at. And one of the other big challenges is because a novel or a comic book or even an early RPG is a very solitary operation. You usually have one designer or one author or two authors, mm-hmm. or an author and an artist. And so it was a much smaller team as far as putting things together, which has the advantage of a lot more control, but the disadvantage that sometimes it's kind of lonely and you don't know who to really talk to about your problems. When you're dealing with a computer game, it's a much larger team. It's a lot of very talented people. It's a lot of people who want to, you know, basically get their ideas across, create a whole, you know, leave their print. People work better when they have a piece of the action. So being able to bring people together to create a consensus, to get them going in one direction, is one of the challenges for a narrative designer. We aren't the keeper of the vision, and there are people whose job it is to keep the vision of the product, but we are in many ways the communicator. And when I've worked on Guild Wars and Guild Wars 2, we would have story time with Uncle Jeff and Aunt Reese Osby, who worked with me on Guild Wars 2. And, you know, the animators would come in and we'd sit down and we'd tell them the story of the next expansion and what's going on. And, you know, they'd have ideas and we'd go back and forth. But this was sort of like creating a central post around which everybody could agree on about the world.
Interesting. So was Sean Ferguson there while you were at ArenaNet?
Sean Ferguson. Yes, the name is familiar.
Yeah, so in Guild Wars, the original Guild Wars, I led like the world's largest guild. We had like 600 players. He was my second in command.
Ah, okay.
And we were doing one of the alpha tests, and they did a call for new writers for Guild Wars, for some of the upcoming expansions. And so he actually took a position there and had to leave. So
yeah, what was that, GW2 or GW1?
That's GW1. So it was back
factions?
In the day. Yeah, probably factions.
Okay,
is my guess. So
I arrived like 2 weeks before the four factions, you know, went live. My job for the first 2 weeks was checking to make sure we didn't say anything obscene in Chinese.
Oh, wow.
So, but, yeah, that was my first task there.
So you read Chinese and speak Chinese?
No, I was there armed with my, you know, dictionaries, and you say, okay, he spelled like that. What does it say? The Google? Nope. Okay, we're fine with that. So
you've been around the RPG industry for close to 40 years. Mm-hmm. How does the industry now compare to when you first started? And I mean, obviously, it's gotten bigger, and I'm actually really curious. Yeah, how's Wizards of the Coast changed from when you first joined to how it's going now?
It's had its ups and downs over the years. It's, you know, I actually live not too far away from where Wizards of the Coast is currently based. When we moved out here, basically we got a house that basically was within a short driving distance. But I don't know many people there anymore because it's been 15 years now, and you know, people have come, people have left, things have changed. So I can't speak to how it is, you know, these days. But it has been an expansion and then challenges that we've hit when I was at TSR and at Wizards of the Coast. The nature of the game has in many ways gotten larger and more impressive, but by the same token, it is a lot more accessible right now. When I started, a lot of people could do zines and their own self-publishing, and you know, you dig up, you know, check out the old Alarums and Excursions, where people would type things up and they'd bind them together and send them out to, you know, a small mailing list. Nowadays it's on the internet, and we've got PDFs, and people have access to, you know, excellent desktop publication software. And the big thing that's hit recently has, of course, been playing online. Has been people who have their groups, Matt Mercer's bunch, the that basically are presenting D&D adventures as theater, effectively. And that format has just worked out real well, and it's been very good for teaching people how to play role playing, because the best way, and I've written more than enough what is role playing columns for various games over the years, it is much easier to sit down with somebody and explain what role playing is, and to bring them in and to play the game with them. And that's what the online community is doing. It's showing people, and it's basically demonstrating, you know, how the game functions and how do we do this. And that has been incredible for, you know, breaking out the game to a new generation. So I think the presence of the internet, both from the idea of stronger communication plus live play, have done wonders for it as well. And it has an effect. The line between professional game designer and amateur is incredibly thin. I mean, it's literally publication. You know, it used to be, you know, if you got something published, you're now a professional game designer. So, you know, and you have, you know, you hang out with your players and you just run stuff. That's fine too. But it was a very accessible, and now as far as on the internet, it is accessible once again. Now getting in with, you know, working for Paizo or working for Wizards of the Coast is a little more of a challenge now. I mean, just because, you know, they are the big guns, and over the years, we, you know, we started using, this is back at TSR, we started using design tests. I did not have a design test. The AD&D was my design test. It was a demonstration. Tracy Hickman had written Ravenloft without any, you know, permission, and was selling it at conventions. And someone, you know, saw it and picked up a copy and sent it to TSR saying, hey, does this violate our copyrights? And Mike Gray, who before and after TSR was working for Milton Bradley, reviewed it and said, yeah, it violates our copyrights, right, left, and center. And it's pretty good. So I would recommend you hire him. And so he got hired, and part of his hiring was TSR suddenly owns the properties that he was working on before, that he was selling illegally before the operation. So it was a very different world back then. I was talking to the Gen Con staff, and every week I would talk to I would call up when I was unemployed the HR department, Bucky. And we would talk, and I'd say, anything going on? And she says, no, we got nothing this week. And at one point I told him, I'm going to be coming out for a wedding. Can I stop by? Now, the wedding was in Indiana, and I didn't tell them that. So I, you know, we went to Indiana for the wedding, drove up to Wisconsin, interviewed, was hired, and came, you know, basically had the interview, came back to the wedding, and this was a weekend type thing. And while I was at the wedding, and this was of a pair of old D&D players from my college campaign. They called me and said, would you, we'd like to hire you. And my team was just, you know, amazed by the fact that, you know, oh my God, you know, one of our guys is working for the company now.
So it seems to me that D&D has started to go mainstream, where you were seeing a lot more in popular media, celebrities are playing and doing things like that. Do you think it's made that transition yet, or is it still more nerd-centric?
I think it's both, but I think that a lot of people who played D&D are now, when they were kids, are now in positions of decision making, and that's reflected on what you're seeing as far as the opportunities for Dungeons and Dragons. So, you know, it basically, a lot of people have grown up. They're going in the second, third generations of, you know, of D&D players. So they are very familiar. And I think it has entered into the common currency and conversation of the media, of the community. So it's not, you know, D&D is not necessarily that strange thing people have, you know, haven't heard about. You might get down to the more indie groups or smaller games, and they would be, you know, like, well, we've never heard of that. But as far as D&D and role playing, I think it has blossomed to the point where people not only know about it, they're, you know, they some of them connected with their parents as far as, oh yeah, my parents played D&D, you know, that sort of thing. I'm doing computer games, or I'm doing live podcasting. You know, my folks are, you know, folks used to play D&D, so. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now I remembered what I was going to ask you. So you were talking about Ravenloft coming over.
Yes.
And it kind of sparked me a question about the open gaming license.
Yes.
So were you with WotC or during that time when that was coming out? Or
yes, I was. I was, you know, basically, I wasn't part of the process by which we put together the OGL. Mm-hmm. But the idea was very much that D&D does better with adventures, but we do not, you know, but adventures take time and money. Dungeon Magazine was an excellent magazine. It would have like four or five adventures in it. So could we, you know, basically license out the engine for other people to basically develop and grow? So basically you have a broader base. Now, what this ended up doing is it ended up creating the D20 glut as everybody got into the act. And originally, you know, we thought they would do adventures, you know, and, you know, character books, that sort of thing, small stuff. But almost immediately they waded in with their own hardbacks. We had one group that basically got its monster manual out before TSR. I'm sorry, before Wizards of the Coast got its monster manual out, because in those days it was we were going to release the player's handbook, then release the DMG 2 months later, then release the monster manual 2 months later. And in that time, they built their own monster manual and got it to press. So they beat us to our own monster manual, because, you know, monster manuals sell. And that was a surprise, I think, to Wizards of the Coast. That, you know, there was just so much. And people did a lot of, you know, here's my adventure, which is real cool. Here are a bunch of monsters, which are real cool. I think one of the best versions of it was actually Mutants and Masterminds, which was from Green Ronin, Steve Kenson. And what it did is turned the design on its head, whereas in the epic fantasy genre, you want the character advancing and getting more powerful over time. In Mutants and Masterminds, which was a superhero genre, you set the level of the adventures you want to run, you know, Spider-Man level or Superman level, whatever. And then you basically use that to determine how powerful your hero is. And I thought that was a very nice mechanic that took the OGL and basically took it in a completely different direction. And that's the type of thing. I mean, traditionally, a lot of companies were doing D&D material without permission, you know, and they might say something like, you know, suitable for any 3D6 RPG, you know, without necessarily saying it outright. And this gave them a little more permission to expand and to handle it. Now, we did not have any type of review process. We could not put any type of quality control on it. So you saw a lot of stuff that came out at the time. So it had pluses and it had minuses. It basically got a larger footprint for D&D out there from a lot of people all, you know, campaigning, but it also glutted the market.
Has it, do you think it's been reined in better now, and that, you're seeing higher quality from, you know, companies like Jason's company, Legendary Games, and things like that?
I think it has. I think there's a lot of there was some fallout. And, you know, again, one of those dark times from over stuff. I think it's a little more under control. And I think the material that's being generated is real good. And there, in addition to the OGL, that brings about the old school Renaissance, Reformation, you know, the people who are going back to the original D&D BX series. And basically using that as a foundation. These are, you know, basically saying, I like the game back here. Let's make it like this. One thing I always say about game design is that it's a conversation. It is, you design something, you create something, you put it out there, and people say, I like that. But you need to do something over here. Let me show you how to fix it. Or, this is an inspiration, but we can do better. And you can see how games evolve when there's like lineages of, you know, of games where you can trace back, you know, where they, nothing comes out fully formed, and see how, where they came from and what people were doing before and who the antecedents are. So this is I think that's one of the great things about game design is that, you know, it is an evolutionary process, and people take it in directions that TSR or Wizards of the Coast would never go, and that's okay. You know, basically they're creating their own genres.
Are you playing any games now?
Yes, I'm involved in two games. One is a player and one is a GM. The game I'm playing in is D&D 5th edition Caverns of Archaea, which is, and our, my, DM is Steve Winter, who is a fantastic editor and one of the great heroes of the, I've known him for years. He was my, co-creator on the original, Marvel Superheroes game. And he came out here working with, Wizards of the Coast as well. And we've, you know, doesn't live too far away. We all get online. And we all play, you know, our group has, oh goodness, a programmer, a young architect, a producer from Amazon Games that I work with, a Tolkien scholar, a cartoonist. Yeah, so we've got a good, nice, diverse group. And so we've been, you know, we've been slogging through Caverns all for the past year plus, but all the way through the COVID experience. I'm running with most of the same group a Call of Cthulhu game, and this has been going on with various keepers for, oh goodness, years and years now. One of us would pick up the slack and we would, you know, basically run for a while, and I tend to get caught in with the big ticket items. Right now, we're finishing up Masks of Nyarlathotep.
So, I hear your cat.
Yeah, I apologize for that.
That's okay. That's
is that going to interrupt your recording?
No. That's great.
Yes. So. The cat here is Kaya. She's also known as the Ninja Kitty. She's a small black and white cat, and she meows very loudly. So. I closed the door because she forced it open, and I can hear conversations from the. My wife actually is playing with her D&D group tonight.
Excellent. So Wednesday night is my night, so
she's got her own gang, and they've been, you know, running D&D and D6 Star Wars, and she's been doing her own young people's school with magic adventures. And, you know, they've been doing very well. We've all got set up on Discord to handle it, and just, you know, it's all theater of the mind. Call of Cthulhu works very well without a board. You can just talk, and basically, you know, by the time someone has to roll dice, things have gone horribly, horribly wrong. for Caverns, we do roll 20. Which was very good. And Steve's been experimenting with, you know, what we can do with light sources and what we can do with, you know, the various layers and maps. So he's been really embracing that.
How do you like 5e compared to the earlier editions?
I like 5e. Now, I say that with a big caveat because I like all the drafts. I've played all. I mean, I like I said, go back to the little wood grain box there, and it was the greatest thing I ever played. And first edition came out, it was the greatest thing I ever played. Mm-hmm. Second edition, they all the various versions and the halfway versions all tell a story of what the company, what the individuals involved were trying to do, and the version of D&D that they want to tell. I think fifth edition does very well with keeping a lot of power with the players and the DM. I think the use of the advantage-disadvantage system is very, very good. I read an early draft of the game, an early manuscript version of it, and it was okay. You know, it wasn't any better than anything that comes out of the OSR. You know, they got all the pieces there, everything lines up, but, you know, they didn't do anything to bring the game forward. And I think things like the advantage-disadvantage system did a very good job of making a simple mechanic that had very deep resonance within the game.
So what advice do you have for aspiring writers looking to either do novels or get into RPGs or even writing for computer games?
Flee, you fools. it's difficult. It's very different. I mean, as I said, from telling my origin story, that type of path, I don't know if it exists anymore. By the same token, other paths do exist that have opened up. People go to school now for computer games. People basically have the opportunity of, you can start with a ground level, here is my OSR version of D&D, and grow from there. You can get things published. You can get high quality printing that wasn't available to us at that time. So there's a lot of opportunity there. As far as joining the larger companies, there's a challenge there, and everybody's got their own story for how they ended up at Paizo or at TSO or Kobold. There are a lot of rising stars. Kobold Press has been under Wolfgang Bauer, has been very, very good at bringing a lot of good young talent into the into it, and producing a lot of very quality works. They're friends. I would plug them. You know, we just celebrated the 15th year anniversary. Yep. So there is a lot of potential out there, but there's a lot of potential for establishing a rep on your own. So much like Tracy or me with the Dungeons and Dragons Open, was you can produce and say, here, I did this. This is what I can stand on. Tell me, can you use somebody like that? Computer game companies. One thing that was great about Guild Wars and Guild Wars 2 was that we had QA in house. So a lot of people joined up in QA and then rose up. And again, because they knew where the bodies were buried, they became designers. They became managers. They basically grew into their positions. So as a career path, QA has. In fact, we had one of my writers on a recent project at Amazon started as contract, and she was recently made full time, which I think is a great thing, because this is the type of thing of being able to grow into the game, and you know what's going on. You've been there. Jumped in the corner 47 times, so you know where the exploits are, is a great way for the hands-on experience as far as computer games are concerned. Knowledge of tech is helpful. That's a weak spot that I have in my own background, because I come mostly from storytelling, mostly from D&D. It's basically understanding the mechanics of how things not only happen within the computer, but how they are made. The computer, I always point out, use the bunny example. Yeah, on the computer game, you see a bunny hopping across the screen in the background. 12 people sweat bullets to put that bunny in that game. Somebody had to concept the bunny. Somebody had to draw the bunny. Somebody had to put the skin of the bunny. Somebody had to make the skeleton of the bunny. Somebody had to basically animate the bunny. Somebody had to get the behavior of the bunny right. Someone had to say, look, there's a bunny. That was my job. And basically, this is why I say, when I say computer games are a collaborative effort and a cooperative effort, it's because everything that is there is because a team of people worked very hard to make it happen.
So what's next for Jeff? What's a cool thing that you're working on that you can actually talk about?
I'm working on stuff for Amazon Games. I cannot talk about that. I do occasional work for Kobold essays for them. I've got nothing in the hopper right now, but you know, it's only a matter of time. In the real world, I've actually been writing plays.
Wow, really?
I took a playwriting class, this about 5 years ago, with the Seattle Rep, because, you know, I'm always working, try to, you know, improve the craft. And afterwards, our class stayed together. So we get together once a month and we read, you know, bits of our plays.
Yeah.
And I've like had one that we actually had a reading at a theater with, you know, a whole group of people that was, you know, very, very productive and gave me a lot of good feedback. So that plays in revision. Another couple that are just, you know, wrapped up, some that are practically skits, which are like, I call them done in ones because they're like a 10 minute play. And there are people who basically do festivals of 10 minute plays. You know, but in the before times, Seattle had a very, strong theater, background. And I got into theater and I've been in like two plays and these were both in college. And my mother-in-law was a director and actress in Pittsburgh. And for these plays, she needed bodies. So like they did 10 Little Indians and they needed the victims. And so I was basically, we got recruited into helping out with the theater through my wife's mom. And so I was in Arsenic and Old Lace. I was in 10 Little Indians. And that gave me just enough to say, okay, I'm not an actor, but I can play one on TV. I can play one on the printed page. And the idea of how theater works and the mechanics and basically all the subtext that operates within a good play is something that I carry forward and use in my my writing for cinematics or events or character conversations or that sort of thing. So I'm enjoying it because it's a very personal thing as opposed to I am doing this for a deadline or I have to show this to people. So I've been actually kind of enjoying that of late.
So are we going to see the Jeff Grubb one man show sometime then?
Perhaps. I really don't know where this is going to go. I'm just very happy to get to the end of a play and say, okay, this feels good. It doesn't need to necessarily go any further for me. It's been very rewarding. So I would say I'm writing for myself when I'm doing that, as opposed to I'm writing for a larger audience or people who play D&D or people who will be playing this computer game. I'm not thinking beyond just the idea of, yes, this makes me feel very, very happy. And actually, I've done a couple small articles for the Excellent Traveling volume, which is an Empire of the Petal Throne zine. Which, you know, and I'm a fan. I'm a pedal head. I've got several editions of this, you know. I don't know if you know about EPT.
I do not.
Empire of the Pedal Throne was pretty much the first world. You know, we had Greyhawk and Dragonlance. Greyhawk and Blackmoor back at the dawn of time. And, you know, these were pulling things from their campaigns. But this was a box set. It was, 76 or so. It was like a dawn. And it was a fantasy adventure, non-Western European science fiction post-Holocaust game, and it basically was set on the world called Tecomel. It was created by a philosophy linguistic professor up in Minneapolis named M.A.R. Barker, and it did a lot of things back then that we wouldn't catch up to until the 80s. As far as presenting a world, as far as you're creating a deep, because he had a fantasy world that much like Tolkien, that he was building, and the avenue by which he presented it was role-playing games. And so there's still a very strong and dedicated small fanzine group that basically enjoys. They have podcasts that plays Empire of the Petal Throne. And it's one of those things I'd recommend. And since then, like, five different companies have all come in with different systems and different ways of presenting it. And they've all had, you know, their strengths. But, you know, the original tends to be the one everybody, if they've heard about, they've heard of that one.
I seem to remember seeing that box. I started playing in the late 70s. So I seem to recall a box set that had all those genres kind of mixed together.
It basically had sort of an Aztec, South Asian. It was a white box with this ornate cover. You know, it looked completely bizarre. What I remember, I did not pick up a copy back then because it was $25. My God, who's going to pay $25 for a game, you know?
All right, here's my last and most important question. What are the odds that Marvel Superheroes RPG is going to come back given the explosion of all these superhero movies and things?
Marvel has come back as several RPGs over the years. Wizards of the Coast did one, The Saga. Margaret Weiss Productions did one. There was one involving stones that were there. I'm aware of them because whenever they do a review, they compare it back to the little yellow box we did way back in the dawn, which is always nice, but it was a different era. I don't know. I think they would. One of the things that one of those special moments that happened for us at the dawn of time with the Marvel Superheroes game was it was the right product at the right time. We were getting the direct sale market up. It was expanding out. It was people were, coming into comics for the first time. It was a great, it was basically working with Marvel at the time was fantastic. We had access to their back art. I would basically say, I need these figures for an upcoming thing. And they would send a guy over to Jersey, which was where the warehouse where all the stats were, and they would take a picture of it, a stat, and they would Federal Express it to us. So we it was really good. I don't know if we would see another Marvel game. The Marvel engine continues on. There are a number of people who have their own old school variants of Marvel. Who are building there's a Facebook community, an internet community that basically, is keeping up with all of the superheroes as they get added to the Marvel universe. So basically they keep statting everything up they continue. And if I was to come back to it, and Steve and I've talked about this a couple of times, is the idea of how would we evolve? How would we bring it up to date as opposed to, what we were back then? Because we loved it back then. The question is, how have comics changed? How's the people playing changed? What would we want to do to make that the next step? So I would say Marvel, can command a lot of attention for its licenses right now because of the success. And a role-playing game is not that, that big ticket an item as it was back in those days. I mean, having a role-playing game was that was a nice license to have. I mean, Star Wars was, done. It had three movies. It finished up. There's no more coming. And West End games, including Bill Slavicek, basically started putting together all the lore background for it that became the basis for their expanded universe. They took the material that they generated. Bill named Hammerhead from the Cantina scene, the big hammerheaded alien. You see him for like 2 seconds, and then you move on to something else. That's an Athorian. They have huge herd ships that basically sail between the stars. Bill put that together, and basically they filled in the background for all this. And then Lucasfilm, who owned the license, said, great, we're going to use that as a foundation. And they basically continued to build out on it. They had I did a Star Wars novel. They had a what they called the Holocron, which was basically a CD with a lock on it that had the information that you could use. They had organized it. They had someone whose job it was to basically keep track of all the lore within the Star Wars universe. So everybody was, was firing on the same principles. When I worked for Wizards of the Coast on the Star Wars D20 game, I wrote a adventure, a big 128-page adventure with Owen Stevens called Tempest Feud, and it was about huts, and I had the opportunity to later write a novel in the Star Wars universe. I gave him several suggestions, including Tempest Feud and the autobiography of Jar Jar Binks. They didn't take that one. On the basis of that, they sent me all the information they had on huts, and most of it was things I had written for this adventure 10 years before. So basically I was my own source material. As far as huts were concerned, I had the ring on it. So I basically wrote a hut story based on what I had written earlier. So it was one of the last ones before they brought the new movies on and revised everything again.
Well, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. I really enjoyed this, and I wish we had a couple more hours just to keep hearing these stories.
I'm sorry, I have a tendency to go on.
No, it's great. It's been great. Thanks again.
Okie doke. Thank you.